So I'm here in the Birmingham Buddhist Centre with Dharma Sholi. Thank you for taking part in the project.
Hello. No worries. Very happy to be part of it.
No. So I wanted to start by asking you, what started it all for you? What was the start of the Dharma life for you?
Yeah, so that's a good question, isn't it? Like, how far do you want to go back? Existential angst at the age of 7, or freelance spirituality, or actually walking through the door of a Buddhist centre?
Well, it sounds like there's dukkha in existential angst at the age of 7 to me.
Yeah, okay. So I've got a very loving, supportive, kind family who have been very, very good to me. So then it raises interesting questions. Why is it that some children just kind of feel out of place or questioning or something like that? So I was a very nervous child and... yeah, really quite socially anxious. And in part, one of the ways I coped with that was I got very, very interested in Dungeons and Dragons and the Lord of the Rings and fantasy at a really quite young age. So maybe at the age of 7, I found this, here's a myth for you. So under my parents' bed, I found a small black box. And in it, written in red, was the words Dungeons and Dragons. And it just enchanted me and enraptured me. I was a lazy child as well, so... I can't quite remember how this fits into my reading. My reading was very poor. And then I got interested, and then I got, then it really sped up. So it was just this, I suppose this box just, it was a bit like Pandora's box. It just opened up this world of possibility and imagination. But it's interesting because it's not like I was a particularly visually and imaginative child. It was just, so I'm still into Dungeons and Dragons. So here I am, 39 and 3/4 years old, and I'm still trying to work out why is this important to me. And I think at the heart of it, Dungeons and Dragons, is this message that life matters. It's, you know, it's the myth of the hero. It's like life isn't just random and meaningless and boring. It's like you go on a journey and something happens, you meet obstacles, you overcome them, and you make a difference in the world.
What is Dungeons and Dragons?
Dungeons and Dragons, it's a imaginative game where you play an imaginary character who interacts with an environment which is controlled by one person who's kind of controlling the world. So it's sort of like free-form theatre, but there's rules and there's a mechanics to simulate whether or not you succeed in actions, and you roll dice and you all wear black and are very geeky and classically, although increasingly not. So in some ways, that was a thread. And obviously it's very interesting looking back because one has one's narrative of one's life and it's like, well, is this really true or is it? So let's assume the truth of my own narrative. So from the age of 7, that's what I was interested in. By the time I was 12 or 13, I was less socially anxious, and I suppose I was a bit in the not bothered, why care phase. But Dungeons and Dragons was still there. And at some point, one of my relatives gave me a book, like the Reader's Digest of the Unexplained, and it was all of these kind of like ghost stories and Yeti sightings and all of that. And somehow that desire for meaning in life somehow transitioned into real magic, in inverted commas, you know, the magical mystery of the world. Yeah, let's say that. So then that interest expanded. Then when I was 16, I went to sixth form college and started smoking weed. At the time, my friends from secondary school were very kind of laddie lads, as it were, kind of beer and football, which were really not my interests. And I remember meeting these other kids who were into getting stoned. And I was a very sort of straight-laced good boy who was afraid of getting into trouble. And I just immediately gravitated to these guys and went off and got into getting stoned with them. Which I think vexed my mother. And in somehow that was another flowering of, like drug-based experience as a way of experiencing consciousness as being broader, different, bigger. So that was very important to me. Then, as is often the way drugs, I was afraid, I was running away from my emotions, and it got darker, it got... drugs stopped being about having a good time and started being more and more about escape. Then my first... proper contact with Buddhism was, I was 19 years old. It was a Christmas 98. And my friend had lent me this Sogyal Rinpoche's The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. Yeah. By this time, I was quite interested in New Age thought, and I was a very opinionated stoned person, so we'd have all these conversations about ley lines and Atlantis and all of this. And what was increasingly apparent to me, very, very painfully so, was this, the disparity between the spell I could weave with words and my, like, my core of my emotional experience, and how kind of that was very Yeah, it was very, very painful. It was very painful. And I read this book about Buddhism, and it was revelatory. I don't know if this is true, but I say it's the only dumb book which I've ever cried upon reading, which I certainly did cry reading that one. And particularly what was going through my mind at that time was a very sort of 19-year-old existential version, or kind of, dramatised version of existential angst. It's like, I can't cope. And really it was the pain of taking responsibility for my own experience. I just, I'd spent so much time pushing away responsibility that it got harder and harder to act. So anyway, this is the drama, this is the myth. And I was in no way seriously contemplating suicide. It's like, it's just so overdramatic to say that. But somehow my mind played with that, as it's like, at least when you die, you can escape. Then you can escape taking responsibility for your experience. So here I am reading the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. You come to the second section on reincarnation, and Sogyal Rinpoche says, death is not the end. You just have to take responsibility for your experience. And yeah, I wept. I wept upon reading that, because I intuitively knew that it was true. And I knew it was true because I didn't want it to be true, but it was. You know when you want things to be true? And it's like, no, I don't want this, but it's true. Very, very, yeah, I felt very, very moved by that. And he talks, in that section, he talks about his relationship with Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, which I knew nothing about, and it's just very, very beautiful, actually. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that evening I was down the pub in my hometown from university, and one of my mates said, what have you done today? And I said, I discovered I'm a Buddhist. And he was one of my four more philosophically minded stoned friends. So he said, okay, so what are you going to do about it? And I looked at him and I said, I'm going to finish drinking this beer and then I'm going to go over there and have a spliff.
And is that what you did?
Which is what I did. And it was a few more years before that, particularly that split between my inner experience and my outer persona, kind of that split continued to grow, and it became sufficiently painful that I had to do something about it. Yeah. Mm. And actually, so relatively quickly, just going back a sec, relatively quickly, I didn't finish reading the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. It went into a whole world of Vajrayana visualization, which was unintelligible to me, so I stopped reading it. I read a couple more books on Buddhism, but I increasingly felt that they were all just saying, you need to do this, you need to do this. And I just realised that it was just all words, and until I acted, the words were becoming, they were being dishonoured by my, or something like that. That's putting words into my own mouth, but yeah, it's like, actually, you need to practice, and until you do that, there's no more to read. So anyway, so then we go forward a couple of years, and this is the year 2000. Myself and my dear friend, who's now Sanghanista, we would get stoned and we would sort of talk about Buddhism without talking about it. We both knew if we were interested in it, but we wouldn't quite talk about it. And one day, he wasn't at the pub on a Wednesday night. And at that time, I was at the lowest I've been in my life, probably. And he represented a thread of hope, a thread of possibility, and he didn't come down the pub on Wednesday. And I felt betrayed, actually. I felt deeply hurt. He hadn't promised he would be there, so it's, mm-hmm. there's no... And he didn't have a phone, because he was resisting mobile phones at that point. And on Friday, I was like, where were you? And he said, I was at the Buddhist Centre, you should come. So... And I said, oh, okay. And first of the next week, I did go. So that was the week after my 22nd birthday. So that was very early July 2000. I'd just been to Glastonbury for the second time, and I had a horrific time because of this experience of alienation. And I was greeted by the man who is now Emily Ketu and Harsha Prabha, who are both exemplary in their welcoming and going out to people. Yeah, I can't. Harsha Prabha is a real gift of the order. His capacity to remember people and go towards them is phenomenal. And because
was he the first order member you really met?
Yeah, Harsha Prabha was the first order member I met, and he was very good at spotting young people who were looking for something. So there was a lot of us who came through that era of Harsha Prabha. Amala Ketu, Sanghanista, Karen Adi, Sujani, myself, Sanghamani. So at one point, this is Harsha Prabha's claim to fame, at one point, 25% of the order members under 40 had been taught meditation by him. It was just this particular point where it narrowed and then it spread out again. something like that, 20%.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it about, what, for you when you first met him?
He was just extremely warm and he was just very warm and very friendly and really interested in me as a human being. So he'd, having met Sankanistha a week before, he showed, Sankanistha showed up for me and he was like, oh look, here's another bright existential young guy who's really looking for something. Boom. I think what really touched me the most was, at the time I was into this like 6 degrees of separation. And so he mentioned that he knew Sankaracharya, who I must have read something by. So that I was already like, oh, he's one step away from this kind of like enlightened master teacher guy. But then what really did it was at the end of that first class, he said, oh, do you want to meet up for coffee on Saturday? And oh, I could have cried, just this, you know, this mature older man being interested in me and kind of validating me. It's all, you know, like it's just very classic what we say in Sri Ratna. It's an individual taking personal interest in you. And in my case, it's just utterly true. For class itself, I barely remember anything of it. I found the meditation horrific.
That's a strong word.
Yeah. Which, again, it's dramatised. You know, I've got this dramatised story. And, of course, people ask me and I tell them, so I rehash my dramatised story. So it was for Metta Bhavana, and I had a very direct experience of the degree of emotional alienation I'd allowed myself to get into, and that was definitely unpleasant. So my image at the time, forgive me for drama, was I was in the sea, and it was a big storm, and I was desperately clinging on to like one crappy plank, desperately holding on, and I had two tiny twigs in my hands, and somebody was asking me to light a fire. That was the image which I crafted over the course of my unpleasant experience of the Metta Bhavana. Converse to previous experiences on drugs where, you know, taking ecstasy, and I felt like I was radiating love to the universe. I felt like I was a fire where my aura was kind of 10 feet wide. But I wasn't. I knew that drugs weren't the answer, and I knew meditation was. So I sort of stoically accepted that meditation was part of the deal. But one important thing that evening, at some point during the course of that evening, I decided that this was going to be a turning point in my life. I don't believe that Sri Ratna saved my life. I believe, you know, like I'm an intelligent human being. I would have found something else. But Sri Ratna was the first thing that came along, which helped me turn my life around. And I remember thinking, this night needs to mark a change. This is a new leaf, a new chapter, and it has to be lived. It can't just be an idea, it has to be lived. So I thought to myself, well, you've got three options. You've got meditation, well, that that's not going well. You've got drink and drugs and the stopping of that. I must have been familiar with the five precepts through my reading. I recognised it lacked the individuality or integration to give up that. So I hit upon vegetarianism, and I thought, well, I can be a vegetarian from here on in. And that was the last time I consciously ate meat. I was just like, this is something needs to be different. Because I'm such a talker, I'm so full of it. Kind of positively and negatively. So something, you know, it had to be lived. Yeah, some of this idea of practicing Buddhism must have gone into my mind very strongly.
It was an ethical decision, really.
Yeah. In some ways, I jokingly say to people, I'm one of the few people, I'm a vegetarian because of rites and rituals. Do you see what I mean? Like, we really encourage people to kind of like take on board the ethical consequences and connect with the effect that doing that has on other people. In some ways, no, for me, it's like I wanted a sign. I wanted a ritual signifier of change in my behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's okay. I do think, obviously, the danger with that is that, and this hasn't really happened, but once or twice in my life, if I kind of cast adrift from the practice of Buddhism, then I find myself thinking, well, so why are you a vegetarian? Because I'm a vegetarian because I'm a Buddhist, rather than the other way around, if you see what I mean. But,
So you carried on, I guess, going to that class, and you did learn to meditate.
I did learn to meditate, yes. So again, this is Harsha Prabhu's kind of talent spotting. So he got Sankanistha and I to go on our first weekend retreat within 6 weeks of going to the Buddhist Centre, less than six times, and with a whole kind of like You know, so, yeah, like, it was fine, but it was, you know, like, on the very first night, we're just sitting there. So there's rows, which we're not used to, because it's normally just a splodge of cushions. So there's rows, and we're like, okay, that's weird. And we're sitting down, and everyone else stands up. And I, just before they salute the shrine, I, the thought goes through my mind, oh, I'm about to be exposed to Buddhist ritual. Nobody had told us anything about it. Yeah, doing puja the next night, the same. We had no idea what was going on. You know, like, obviously, it kind of worked because we're still both here.
So this was on the weekend retreat?
This was the weekend retreat, yeah. It was a guy's weekend. And I can remember all of the guys on that first retreat. As, of course, you can, yeah. There's maybe 20 of us. It was a little local retreat. And yeah, like, there's a number of those people who I'm good friends with today.
You all stayed with it?
Yeah, you know, obviously some didn't, but many of us did. Yeah, many of us did and kind of got ordained. And then straight after that, he said, oh, do you want to join my foundation groups, which we started for Sunday night. We got back from the retreat. Maybe the following week, but I think it was the Sunday night we got back. And then I was just at the end of a really stressful and difficult work experience, but it's another story. So this is me straight after university. So I'd just done a year kind of temping and I was in the dot-com bubble in a very stressful and unpleasant way. Totally unqualified for my job. So I stopped that and he said, oh, why don't you go and volunteer at Evolution? So I did that. And then by the February of the next year, so July to February, so like 6 or 7 months, I was working full time for Ipswich Evolution, which, so again, how I tell that story has shifted. I used to describe myself as being empty, and people have challenged me on that. So now I describe myself as being very ready. I was very open. I didn't have a job. I was living with my parents. I didn't have a girlfriend. I needed a life. And Tree Mountain was like, here you go, off. It's like, great, let's go. And there is a magic to that, for that early phase of engagement. You know, we were just talking about how we teach for those first few months, what we teach, which is, I was for a meeting I was having just before doing this interview. And in some ways, what was going through my mind, and we were saying at the time, it's people don't remember the content. What counts is an atmosphere or an experience. So it was a very magical time of opening possibilities and meeting people and making new friends, you know, Sanghamani. Yeah, just entering into the life of a Sangha, which was very, very moving. Yeah. I remember kind of going to a Sangha night, having volunteered at Evolution, and whereas Karen, Sanghamani commenting, it's like, oh, you're sparkling, you're alive. But she also meant it literally, because I physically had glitter on me from putting some of her shiny tat out. It was kind of special time, as it were.
So how long did it take you to ask for ordination?
So I asked for ordination in 2002, May 2002, and I'd been putting off a bit. So this is the old Mitra system. So I asked to become a Mitra in June 2001. One of the requirements was, the old requirements was, you had to be on a week-long retreat. So I went on my first week-long retreat, and then I asked to be a Mitra. And they said no, because I didn't meditate regularly enough, which was probably fair enough, actually. It was probably good to make me wait a bit. So then I became a Mitra in April 2002, went on my first week-long retreat at Padmaloka in May 2002 and asked to become a Mitra during that time. Asked for ordination. And people at home were definitely putting me off. They were saying, oh, no, it's good to just be a Mitra for a year or two. But it's like, yeah, come on. By this time I was 24 years old, and it's like, you just dive in. Yeah, and I remember having a conversation with my mum and she was saying, oh, this isn't... My parents were very pleased to see me getting into Buddhism, of course, because I was mildly depressed and smoking a lot of weed, and suddenly I'm happy and not smoking weed. It's like, the fact that it's this weird religion is definitely not... They weren't bothered about that. And I remember saying to her, oh, what do you make of this? I think I might stay. And there was this conversation, is it about getting better? Or is it about more than that? And I think she said to me, well, it's obviously... No, it's about more than that. This is what you're going to do with your life. And she was obviously, thus far, 18 years later, that was an accurate prediction. And then I remember, you know, they came to my Mitra ceremony, and that was just very lovely. And I think they had a very positive experience of Sangha, basically. Yeah. That they were confident that their son was, whatever he was getting into was good.
That's interesting.
Yeah. They at the time, they said that neither of them were religious, having both been religious in their younger lives, and they said, well, we brought you up to make up your own minds. You've made up your mind. So, like I was never christened. I've never believed in God. I've never prayed to God or had any meaningful sense of him being a real existing figure. So there was no kind of leaving of religion in that respect.
But was there a moment when you realised that you wanted to join the order, or was it more of a
gradual? Oh, yeah, no, okay, so that's another story. So so this must be back in Christmas 2000. So I've been coming to the Buddha Centre 3 months, and I'm going to Sangha night for the first time. And Sangha night, like I was still pretty messed up. So I thought that I exuded negative vibes, and that I disrupt other people's meditation experience. So I was so shy going to Sangha night. I was already in this men's group, this kind of foundation group. So there at Sangha night, it's quite busy. Who knows, it's like 20 people. The Colchester Buddhist Centre at that time was quite small, so I felt busy. And I see Matthew, this old boy, he's got to be in his 80s. And I think, oh, he'll be nice to me. So I go up to him and say, oh, hello, Matthew. Yeah, feeling very exposed. So he looked at me and said, you're going to be an order member one day, aren't you? And again, so this is, you know, one's personal myth, one's personal drama, as it were. So the way I experienced that was that everybody around me went silent and kind of whipped their heads around to see what I was going to say. I felt acutely socially exposed, because at that point I still thought that elder members were kind of like perfect, like ascended beings, angels or something like that. Not quite literally, but, you know, we were still in that first flush of romance. So I stammered out some kind of shy, self-deprecating thing. But also, as soon as he said that, and within my heart parts, I was like, yes, yeah, I will. Yeah, I know. So in some ways, again, he was right, you know. So, yeah, hats off to you, Matthew. You were right. I was too embarrassed to be able to see what you could see in me, I suppose.
How was the journey to ordination for you?
Yeah, it's deciding the length of a version. Predominantly very straightforward. So by 2002, I often do this, I answer your question tangentially. So I was very lucky that the young Buddhist movement, of course, was, you know, many years away from formation at that time, but there happened to be a reasonable gang of us, relatively young people around at the time, Sangha Nista Karanadi, Sangha Mani, Amalaketu, Buddha Siyo over in Ipswich, a few other friends, Sujaimi, and some other friends who didn't get ordained. So I had a sense of it wasn't a choice between Triratna and mates, so that made it much easier. And we kind of like this messy journey of kind of giving up and letting go of unhelpful patterns. Although my friends definitely didn't experience it like this, although quite a few of them probably hadn't asked for ordination. So 2003 was Yashimitra and all of that. So my experience of that was, at that point I was definitely in a somewhat willful endeavour to stop drinking and smoking because it's bad and you shouldn't do it. And all of a sudden it turns out that Sangha Ajita has sex with people. And the way I experienced that was it meant, well, why should I bother trying to stop smoking weed then? You're like, Bante has sex with young men. He's meant to be enlightened. I like smoking weed. I'm not even saying that I'm enlightened. What's the problem? There's a degree of reactivity there, and, you know, the whole kind of the order wobbled, you know. So basically my ordination process took place in a very wobbly period of the order's history and confidence. You know, my second going for refuge retreat, I remember it was just after the letter within, Ashimitra's letter within a month, and I remember the man leading the ordination retreat saying things like, you know, referring to Sangha Ajita as somebody who all of us know and some of us respect. You know, so that sort of language. But my lived experience was, I suppose I remember saying to my Mitra convener when he asked me what to make all of this, and I just said, well, you and nobody I know has ever tried to initiate sex with me. You and everybody I know have only ever been the source of kindness and wisdom and benefit in my life. You know, what's the problem? Yeah, which in some ways it did feel quite straightforward. And, you know, kind of, you know, reading a bit of the FWBO files, and it was so not my experience. You know, they were talking, I remember reading this thing about tree manners hypnotising people through meditation to make them vulnerable to coercion. And, you know, part of me thought, yeah, if only. Yeah, given my meditation experience was still, you know, quite, it was a struggle. I thought I'd be quite happy if somebody would hypnotise me. Yeah, so you, but your question was the process to ordination. So, yeah, going. I liked Padmaloka. I found it quite straightforward. I found it quite easy. My first going for refuge retreat was difficult. It was very big. It was like 70 guys on it. I was on my own. I didn't know anyone. I definitely felt kind of lonely. And the way I coped with loneliness at that time was I kind of go into like puppy mode. Yeah. My friends used to joke, it's like, you know, I'd be like a, what's that, the Andrex advert, those kind of like puppies who go up to people and lick people and kind of bounce all over them. So I just did that, and that was kind of okay in a certain kind of way. Yeah. I found it, the challenge for me was to be more honest. You know, you could say, again, this image of this division between external persona and internal experience. I can frame the whole of my spiritual life in terms of the endeavour to be honest and bring those two things together. Well, it's one way I frame, yeah, my spiritual life, my path, what I'm trying to do.
So integration, really?
Integration. It's funny, isn't it? Because that word really doesn't appeal to me. So it's like honesty, purity, even like purity. I can resonate with. It's like, oh, yeah, this the dark within us, this story of the kind of like there's something deep within me which is dark and unacceptable and other people can't see. I don't really tell that. I don't tell that story anymore. But that was a very strong story for the first, I know, 10 years in the movement. You know, as a jumping on to, just letting that go. It's like, yeah, there's not anything dark within me. Like, sure, I can be grumpy and craving and all of that, but there's no kind of, yeah, there's no kind of evil Atman within me, if you see what I mean. It's like, oh, I am just this flow of experience, and actually that's predominantly warm and kind, and that's me. Yeah, in a way, it's like, yeah, believing, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I've got a whole load of theories about that kind of thing. But so, yeah, so going to Padmaloka was pleasant, straightforward. I lived living in Ipswich, it felt relatively straightforward. Working at Evolution, it felt relatively straightforward. Probably a big turning point for me was 2004. So 4 years into the Triratna, and somewhat arrogantly, I was starting to describe myself as being halfway through my ordination process. And me and a friend of that time, who's not in the movement anymore, a guy called Tim Burnell, we just on a whim, we flew to Glasgow to see the Dalai Lama. Just kind of on a whim, basically. Can't remember why we did that particularly. And that, in a way, that was quite an important experience. One, because, you know, he's doing this whole ritual teaching thing. And at one point, I remember looking at him and just being electrified. And it felt like we were being taken into a higher state of consciousness through listening to him teach. Like it's like speaking wisdom. But then later on in it, he did an initiation. And that really, that felt meaningless to me, and it really strengthened my desire to be ordained within the Triratna community and initiation to be meaningful. You know, like it was doing an initiation for like 15,000 people, and it's in Tibetan and English, and you lose track, and it's like, is this what's going to happen or what's just happened? And yeah, and it starts off with established shunyata, and it's like, I can't bloody do that. So, but anyway, the point of that story is we were just walking down Saki Hall Street, and I just decided to go travelling. I thought, oh, I need to. I had two questions. The questions were, am I really into Buddhism? And can I really make friends? Mm. Yeah. But at the time, I was, this puppy thing was still going on. And it's the question I had was, do people only like me because I make them cups of tea? Yeah. And my conclusion I came to is, I can't answer these questions in whilst living within Triratna, so I need to go. So one of my good friends at Evolution had just really sort of somewhat chaotically bounced out of Evolution. So I gave like Evolution a year's notice, which is a bit me thinking that I'm more important than I am. But I was also probably scared in need of time. So I took a whole year getting ready to go and went travelling to Latin America for 6 months. And That was a really important process of answering that question. Like, I definitely, I stopped meditating. Well, then I started smoking and drinking more. Then I stopped meditating and, forgot the words to the Tiruvannamalai and all of that. But there was, having gone, I'd seen a little handwritten note on the notice board at Padmaloka, which said, "Are you interested in studying with Subhuti? He's talking about setting up a 2-year Dharma training course. If you're interested, contact me. So that was, my very dear friend Vidyaruchi, before he was ordained, put that note up. So I'd contacted him and provisionally signed up for this 2-year. It was for the launch of Dharmapala College, which was in 2006. It was kind of like 2-year study course and blah, 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 blah. So I'd gone to Latin America with that in mind, and I remember this day, again, one of these archetypal days of my life. I was volunteering, having got fed up of drinking and smoking. So I was volunteering teaching English in this little school, and I was sitting on the bus driving back into the city, looking out on this beautiful sign, the warm late afternoon sun, just about to go home and go and meet up with my Spanish girlfriend. And I was thinking, my Latin girlfriend, I could just stay here and kind of, marry Isabel and kind of teach meditation here. That would be nice. And then I thought, oh no, actually I'd not marry Isabel, I'd trade her in for a prettier girl. just this kind of like, just the idyll of it. It was just so, and then just very clearly in my mind, the voice came, no, you're not. You're going to go back to the UK and you're going to go to do this Dharma course and you're going to get ordained. And I did. And the reason, so Dharma Dutta, 2006 to 2007, that was quite an important phase in my life. That was here in Birmingham. That's when I first came to Birmingham. Vidyaruchi is one of my best friends. We met each other through doing that. I just lightened up, actually. And it was interesting. People said, you must be really interested in study. I'm like, no, I'm not interested in study at all. I'm interested in leading a wholehearted Dharma life. And it's important to me that I know what I'm talking about, because I am going to end up teaching and I don't want to be a blagger. I want to have some depth. That was a really important motto for me, which I think I've lived through, actually. Like, I think, like I do, that's another story, but I do, like, I do make things up as I go along, but I think I got enough depth out of Dharma Dutta. I got the principles deeply enough that I can do that successfully, I think.
So the Dharma Dutta course, was a 2-year residential course?
2-year residential course. Yeah, really expensive. Like, when you look back on it, it was a bit of a mess. Subhuti, 2006, 2007 were very difficult years for Subhuti. It was right for, like his, he talks about it in other places, so I'm not doing any disservice to him by saying, but it was very difficult years for, the end of Majjhimaloka and out of relationship with Bhante. And so it was a bit chaotic and messy. But in some ways, I had very low expectations. So I wanted to meet Subhuti, I wanted to learn the MVC, and I wanted to go to India. I did all of those things, so I was quite happy.
So that was all part of the course?
That was all part of the course, yeah.
Yes. I'm just wondering a bit more about what it was like.
Oh, God. It's funny, I don't talk about that phase of my life very much at all. So me and Vidyaruchi were living in Majjhimaloka, which was definitely like a, posting on Facebook, not that Facebook quite existed, but like, get my 4-story mansion. There's a part of me which likes to show off. So when I moved in, I worked out there were 200 years of order experience, not counting Bhante, in the house. But actually, Majjhimaloka was in dissolution. People were leaving, and they were all just bored. And so me and Vidyaruchi bounced up and we brought some life to the place, because I don't know what it's like for women, but men need stimulation. So I've talked to other people about this. It's like, there's not a lot to say to each of us, but then you get some bright young mitras and you're asking questions or you feel like you can positively influence, and it brings a bit more life to the place, actually. Mm-hmm. David Mitra, another dear friend who was having a very difficult time at that time, coping with the dissolution of Majjhimaloka and kind of, and we just used to bounce up to him, and this isn't Vidyaruchi's memory, but this is mine, and I used to think of him as, the Lion King, the cartoon, and the Scar. So Scar's, or whatever his name, the evil brother, David Mitchell was by no means evil, but that sort of, me and Vidyaruchi were like these two, like in the early scenes when Simba's just bouncing around and he kind of comes up to his uncle and just bites him on the tail to see if he can get a rise. And he just looks at them and is like, don't push it. And it felt a bit, that's what David Mitchell felt like to me, this very kind of, very contained, magisterial figure. And we would just come up to him and kind of like push him and tease him and see if we could get a rise out of him. And he could have just kind of gone poof at any moment, but he didn't, because unlike, Simba's uncle in The Lion King, he was acting out of kindness and awareness. But yeah, and Sangha Dev are people who are, important friends of mine. And particularly Subhuti. So one of my favourite stories about Subhuti, which I tell this story a lot. So Subhuti wasn't a Majjhimaloka when we arrived, but obviously he was who I was there for. He's the big cheese. So after he showed up a couple of months in, by which time Dharmadutta was already a bit of a mess. It's already a bit dysfunctional, kind of like personality dynamics, and the guy leading it is just kind of, in multiple interpretations, I would say that there were too many people who wanted too many different things and they'd all been told they could have it, and that was creating tension. And in some ways it wasn't so bad for me, because what I wanted wasn't one of the people, and you've got some people who want hardcore study and you want other people who want hardcore community, and it's like you can't reconcile these ones. Basically it was, 10 to 1 kind of study discussion. That was it, basically. So we did, 10 to 1 something. And we would study different things, but it was it was just really random what we did. We didn't do a comprehensive overview of Bhante's teaching. We didn't really do a comprehensive overview of the Pali Canon. In some ways, it's quite hard to say what we did learn. But I suppose what I got from Subhuti primarily was clear, principial understanding of what the Dhamma is and what Bhante taught. And that's kind of what I run on. I'm still running on that. 10 years later.
So was he there all the way through?
He blipped in and out. So he would take us for like 2 weeks and we'd be with him every day for 2 weeks and then it'd be off, and then three months later he'd be back and he'd do another block and all of that. Mm-hmm. So Subhuti's quite important to what comes next. So I'll say a bit more about him. So he'd just come back from India, and people, bearing in mind this is 2006, so this is Subhuti at his lowest. Well, of course, I don't know that, because I'm just some new guy. And so somebody says to him, "So Subhuti, how was India?" We're all sitting around the dinner table. And so he tells some stories. So the story I remember is he tells this story about doing this Dharma tour where it's a different city every night. And it's exhausting. And so he's given this talk, and then he's gone back to his hotel. And the arrangement is, I don't know the details of it, but I kind of see it in my mind. The arrangement is he goes into his hotel room at like 10:30 at night, and he comes out again at kind of 8:30 the next morning, and there's a big do not disturb sign because he needs that time. So he's back at his hotel room, and somebody knocks on his door at like 11 or 11:15 or whatever. And it's one of his best friends in India. And he says, "What do you want?" And they say, "There's someone here I think you should talk to. Can you do it?" And Subhuti says, "You know how important this time is to me, but I trust you. If you think I need to talk to him, then I'll talk to him." So he comes out and meets this guy, or brings this guy in. Again, this is one of these mythological stories in my mind. And basically this guy says, "I'm from the Matang caste," which is the kind of like the equal caste of the Mahas who predominantly became Buddhist and they haven't. This is basic Ambedkarism stuff. So the Ambedkarite community is massively improved and the Matangs haven't, because they're still living as untouchables, as Dalits. He says, "So I came into the city today looking for work. I couldn't find any. I've got 30 rupees in my pocket and I'm just about to go and buy some hooch and get drunk because life is so painful. And then I can't cope. And then I see this big crowd of people and I go to see what they're talking about. And I get close enough to hear, and it's you, and you're talking about Dr. Ambedkar's message, and you're talking about his message that we can take responsibility for our minds and we can be free from the hell of caste. And I just want to say to you that I hear your message and I feel it. I feel that I can be free from the hell of caste. I feel that I can take responsibility for my life. I can feel that I can transform my mind and the lives of people around me. And I just want to say thank you for that gift." I can feel it now. I've told this story so many times. I just find that so emotional. And Subhuti's like, "Thank you. Thank you for sharing that with me. May it be so." And of course, the guy walks off. And frankly, the chances of him achieving that are astronomically low. It's so hard to turn around. But then what really gets me, this is the thing which I find really moving, Subhuti says, that made it all worthwhile. That moment made my whole life worthwhile, just being able to do that for that one person. And that's where I just really rejoice in Subhuti, because it's like, like in terms of his influence in India, we are talking about tens of thousands of people who he's been able to communicate that message to.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's something... Well, there's so many things to celebrate, Max, and there's what Subhuti's done for so many people, for us, for me, for True Ratna. But I think there's a deeper message in it, where we can get so hung up on, is this worth it, and what are we doing, and where are we going? And it's like, well, it's just that basic thing. It's like, if we can help one person move towards freedom, it's worth it. It's worth it. That has to be true.
Yeah.
And it's funny that I find that so moving. I'm sure you can hear that in my voice. Because it's not that I'm particularly prone to dark moods or doubting what I do with myself. So it's, I don't... But yet somehow that's still important to me. And I can see it in my own life, in my own way. You have the people here. Yeah, we do change people's lives. Yeah, that counts. That's worth it. It has to be. It is. So to carry on with the story, that's the emotional point, isn't it? So Dharmadutta, it's just a bit... It's good, it's a bit messy. Go to India, get inspired.
So that was part of the course.
That was 2006, so that was the 40th anniversaries, and which was, in a way it was a bit of a mess. There was this talk of this political figure converting to Buddhism, so they were talking about tens of millions of people converting to Buddhism that year, which didn't materialise. He died, kind of like Kailanji? No, that's something else. Can't even remember his name. But anyway, very amazing and inspiring and frustrating and dysfunctional and all the rest of it. But anyway, so then we scroll forward to 2007. I think I'm ready to be ordained by now. And in some ways, so this whole thing came out of how was my ordination process. So in some ways, my ordination process was very lucky, because I thought I was... In 2005, I wasn't ready, and I'd just been away in Latin America. And then I did this two-year thing where I couldn't get ordained. So then by 2008, I was obviously ready. So that whole kind of like, will they, won't they, just skipped all of that. That didn't come up. That wasn't a problem. So at some point in 2007, Subhuti and I were becoming friends to some extent. I was very... deferential around him. But I remember one day there was a particular problem. I went and knocked on his door and I said, have you got 10 minutes? This is when he still lived at my... He's staying at Majumdar. He probably didn't live there by then. He moved to my screen during this time. And I wanted to talk to him about a particular problem. We ended up... I said, have you got 10 minutes? And as always, it takes an hour. And by the end of it, I said to him, tell me what to do in my life. Yeah, tell me what to do. Yeah, I didn't mean to say that. What next? So basically, sometime in 2007, May 2007, he phones me on my mobile and says hello to me. If anyone wants to talk to Vidyarichi's, Subhuti's known Vidyarichi since he was a child, and they've got a very close relationship. So, and I always lived in a world where, well, Vidyarichi's Subhuti's friend and I just know him a bit. Anyway, so he talks to Vidyarichi, and then the phone comes back to me, and Subhuti says, you don't have to decide right away, but will you come and work for me once you finish doing Dharmadutta? And it's one of those moments where, again, slightly mythologized, I feel there's two paths open before me. The path where I say no and the path where I say yes. And I kind of spin all of this, I'd need to think about it, and there's some unclarity about support and money, and I'd need to talk to my preceptor, my public preceptor, my prospective private and public preceptors. Blah, 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 blah. And I say to him, I'm playing it cool, but basically I'm going to say yes, because how can I not? And I go off and talk to him, and I'm saying, well, if I say no to this, I'm just going to spend the rest of my life wondering what would have happened if I'd have said yes. So I do say yes, and so we finished Dharmadutta in November 2007. And so I have the good fortune then, at the end of that time, I've had my invite to get ordained by now. And... We're kind of rejoicing, and we're doing a kind of closing of the course, which they never do again, because it was financial, blah, 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 it didn't work. But so it's this one-off thing, and we're closing it, and I rejoice in Bante, I turn his face in a group of about 20 people, and I say, and what I say to him, which I think I really stand by, I say, Bhante, so when I first came to True Mountain, what I loved about it was the atmosphere, the people, the culture, the openness, the friendliness. Over time, I've come to, and taken quite a long time, frankly, I've come to appreciate the clarity of your teachings. But now here I am, now I realise that actually the culture that I liked from day one is a direct result of you and your character. They are not different. I say this to people a lot, particularly when they're being critical about it. I say, well, look, this conversation we're having, the understanding of Kalyana Mitrata, which allows the conversation I'm having with you right now, it's an expression of Bhante's vision of the Dharma. You can't separate from that, actually. So it's in my naivety, I tried to get people, as a teacher, I tried to teach people things that I wish I'd been taught earlier. So I tried to teach people that. And I often think, yeah, they're not going to get it. I tried to get Mitras to understand that, you know, like a couple of years into being a Mitra. And I'm like, well, let's see. Like, it took me 7 years and I'm expecting you to get it in two. Maybe that's not fair on either of us. So went to India, got stressed, had an adventure. 2007 and 8 were bonkers. So finished Dhammadutta in November 2007. A week later, flew to India on my own. Had an adventure there, came back in February, in April went to Kukuloka for 4 months, came back a month later, went to India for 6 months, not knowing where I was going to live when I came home. Moved to my square to live in Srimala and Spooty, although that wasn't on the cards. So that was a whole... Yeah, that was a bit bonkers. So do you want to ask me any specific things about that? Because I thought I could just... There's too many stories.
Well, in the midst of that, you were given your name.
Yeah.
Maybe you could say a bit about that.
Yeah, so... Yeah, because I haven't told you anything about Sadaraja. So Sadaraja from Cambridge is my private preceptor. I'm just going to back up a bit and talk a little bit about my relationship with him. So he was the shop visitor. So he'd left Ipswich by the time I showed up. But he was still the kind of like the father, of that, as it were, of that situation. So... but I got to know him, and at that time, so then, and the whole kind of preceptor question was a bit complicated. It was, so this is like 2003, 2004, it's still a new era, there's not so many preceptors on the scene. And I felt like I needed to make a decision. Did I want a big name, or did I want somebody who knew me? So did I want Padmavajra or Artapriya? Neither of whom probably would have said yes, actually. And I decided what I wanted, again, this bringing together, I wanted somebody who really knew me. I wanted someone I could have a human relationship with. So I asked Sadaraja in 2004, and then we got to know each other more over the following 4 years. And I'm just increasingly impressed by him. Like, I asked him to ordain me because he was my friend, and more, I've got more and more respect for his Dharma practice, which, of course, is the crucial component. So he gave me my name, and as one does, one's kind of fantasising beforehand about what name you're going to get. Just before going to Kukuloka, I'd said, in terms of sadness, we talked about Waitara or Padmasambhava, I'd said Waitara, and Sadaraja, being a very conscientious man, he's like, right, okay, so I'll do the sadhana every day until I get there, so I've got some momentum behind it to give it to you. Get to Kukuloka, within a week, I'm like, it's not Waitara, it's Padmasambhava. Feel a bit like... and it was something about Padmasambhava being a man, frankly, that felt, particularly getting to Kukuloka, it's something about... I'm not an effeminate man, but I have ease, you know, like I'm quite emotionally open. I in terms of feminine qualities, I can access them relatively easily, I would say. And so there was something about Padmalokaha, Padmasambhava, this masculine energy that was very important. Anyway, so I'm getting ordained, and Marian Makuti, and Sadaraja does it this particular way. He's an artist, so he gave me this envelope which had kind of like blue watercolour on the edge, which is symbolising Shunitana. So I had to open it. He didn't tell me his name. He gave me. And I pulled it out, and what it said, of course, is Dharmashan, and he who abides in the Dharma. And so I had a number of immediate thoughts. My first thought was, oh no, So the reason I thought, oh no, is because it's like he who is full of dumb is like, oh no, that means I have to take wisdom seriously. Why can't you just call me friendly, nice person? I'm good at that. No. And connected with that, because again, you've got this the inner and outer thing. So this play of like Dharma Shalan, Dharma Charlatan. Like I think almost as soon as I read it, I thought that's a real danger. You need to watch out for that because I can talk and I can appear very eloquent. I am very eloquent, good with words, good with ideas. So there I was, Dharma Shalin, he who is full of the Dharma, he who is rich in the Dharma, he who abounds in the Dharma, he who teems with the Dharma, which is still... But I kind of took it. I was like, okay, that's... There you go. So there was no sort of like, I don't want this name, or I feel like you haven't seen me. It's like, okay, that's who I am then. And talking about it a few days afterwards, I said to him, so why did you do that? Why didn't you call me friendly, nice person? And he just said to me very straight, it's like, you don't need any encouragement with that. This is the part of you need to take seriously. This is what you need to grow into. And I was like, drat. Oh no. And certainly for the first quite a few years, probably 3 or 4 years afterwards, I'd always, when people asked me what my name meant, I'd always do some kind of self-deprecating remark and some kind of something. And I've stopped doing that now. I say, like, obviously I don't want to seek to be arrogant, so I say, people ask me, so it means he who is full of a Dharma, he is full of a truth. Because often you're talking to people who are quite new, so they don't know what Dharma means. And I say, obviously that's a name to be lived up to. I don't feel that I am full of Dharma, but I don't, I feel like I've taken it on, I've grown into it, and, well, I suppose people reflect back to me for various, that I am well-named, so that kind of self-deprecating part of my character is kind of, I don't do that anymore.
And Padmasambhava?
Yeah, so Padmasambhava, I have a complex relationship with Padmasambhava. We're saying this in March 2018. Who knows where it will be when somebody else listens to this. I haven't done my sadhana for quite some time. I feel a very deep conviction that Padmasambhava is love. And I can argue that quite forcefully. I feel that very forcefully, very clearly. So there is something there because... You know, like I often say, I don't really get on with my sadhana. And then they say, what do you think about it? I say, Padmasambhava is love. And they're like, whoa, okay, there's something going on there. I don't know.
Yeah. Sadhana's the practice. Yidam.
Yeah,
does that make any difference, talking in that sense?
Yeah, so Padmasambhava is my yidam. I feel quite happy with Padmasambhava as sadhana. I find it confusing. And again, you know, this sort of like the propensity to negative self-criticise. Some of my very dear friends who've got ordained around the same time as me have got very, very vivid relationships with their sadhanas, very alive. And I can kind of get into that, I'm bad and wrong, and I can just be like, well, I can celebrate that relationship. And in some ways I can feel some sadness, I can feel some loss because... they've invested the time and emotional energy to make that alive. So it's not like they've got something I haven't, particularly, although I think they are more devotional and more easily accessed meditation for me. But fundamentally, they've invested the time in developing that relationship and I haven't, and therefore they have it and I don't.
Mm.
And there is sadness there. But I also think, you know, one of the threads we haven't talked about is the journey... Well, where do we draw confidence from in our Dharma lives? And you're like, meditation has never been a source of confidence for me. I still, very topically at the moment, I'm still really trying to shift a sense of shame and inadequacy about my relationship with meditation. And so then why am I looking for Padmasambhava in meditation? You could put it like that, actually.
I think that's why I asked if you thought about Padmasambhava Yidam rather than sadhana, which is specifically associated with meditation, if that was different.
I think it is. It's like, that quality of, just Padmasambhava is love, Padmasambhava is engaged communication. Well, that's what I'm doing with my life, that is my practice. That's where you see the greatest success. very clearly. I was talking about it recently in my metro study group, and I was saying, on a similar veins, I was saying, I'm not very interested in focus in meditation. I find it quite difficult temperamentally, and I'm not very interested, I'm much more interested in breath. And one of the guys in my group who's very sparing with compliments, he said to me, "The thing is, Dhamshala, and you're the best listener I've ever met. When you listen to me, I feel like you're completely attending to me." So I took that quite seriously, because I say he's very, very sparing with compliments, and he didn't need to say that. So that was just a couple of weeks ago, so I'm still, what does that mean? If you see what I mean.
What's coming into my mind is something you were saying earlier about being a mess in progress school. I wondered if you could say a bit more about that. It feels like we might be in that territory.
Because I can tie the chronology together. So I worked for Spooty 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, and that was a rich, wonderful time, but also quite difficult. I've got quite a strong propensity to anxiety and stress and over-responsibility, which Spooty was always very kind to me, but I think I was over-responsible, and I don't find it easy to give people bad news, so that one of your jobs as Spooty's secretary is to act as a filter system for the outside world, and I think I didn't always serve him well in that respect. Sometimes I think I filtered things which he didn't want to know about, because he didn't want to know about them, but he needed to know about them. So then I'd get quite stressed out, and then he'd find out too late, and he wouldn't necessarily have the time to find a creative response, which created difficulty for him. And also I got quite ill, and I got diagnosed as celiac, and there's a whole story of that, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, let's leave that whole chunk of my life and come. So we're in 2011. The Young Buddhist Project started in 2008, and at the time I was completely disinterested, because I was going to India, and that's much more cool and sexy. But I'd bounced out of India, and I'd kind of got interested in the Young Buddhist thing, because that's what all my mates were doing. And particularly what I was acutely aware of was this propensity to stress and anxiety. And I was like, you need to do something about this. I went on my first Young Buddhists weekend in October 2011 and gave this talk. And it was, this is one of these mythological points in my life. So the talk was, it was something like how I work with energy. But anyway, yeah. Anyway, and I was in the middle of chasing all these different girls, and the multiple women I was chasing on this particular retreat, not all at exactly the same time I had been chasing, so it's all a bit complicated. Anyway, and I just felt that, I suppose I'd had 2011 had been a very difficult year for me, bouncing out for working for Spooty, getting diagnosed as celiac, which is quite a thing. I'd been really ill, so just recovering. So by October 2011, I was starting to shine again. It's like, oh, I like it when I shine, I don't like feeling rubbish. And we were just about to give these talks. Singamati gave the first one, and in the course of Singamati giving her talk, I described it as a moment of existential crisis, was what I wanted to say, and I realized what I wanted to say to this 120 people was live your life fully, basically, whatever that means. And I realized that I had to do that too. And it just propelled me into this moment of like, oh my God, what does this mean for who I am and how I live? So Singamati spoke, and I stood up, and I was the most ungrounded I've ever been. Like the first 3 or 4 minutes, I was in existential crisis talking to 120 people. That's a very particular experience. It's quite amusing. You can go back and watch the video, and it's fun. And during the course of that, I kind of land that experience, and I tell you quite a lot of stories, which I've just told you, because they're the marking points in my life. And so this being mess in progress, part of it, in a way, part of my being a mess in progress was standing up more for the light in me, actually. So at the time, I had this tendency, kind of quite self-deprecating, not cynical, but kind of too cool for school kind of things. And I remember Sujani saying to me, or talking about this with her afterwards, and she's saying, the thing is, Dhamshala, it's so obviously not you. You so obviously care. Why can't you just tell people that a bit more, rather than So something about that really went in. So in some ways for me, being a mess in progress has been about having the courage to, yeah, let for how much I care shine through, actually, ironically. And then kind of following that thread. Then I suppose the other thing is just not doing things which stress me out. Not being over-responsible. So there's something about all of that with Sabuti. So just, I can't describe what I did exactly, but just really letting go of... it's feeling like I need to know what to do and how to do it. And if I don't, that makes me a bad and wrong person. So sort of 2012 to 2018, that's been a whole process of slowly letting go of more and more of that. I spent a year at Pamaloka doing one of their kind of intensive things. I was still really ill, so I bounced out of that and then moved to Birmingham. And it was really only when I became Mitch Convener in 2015 that I noticed, oh, I don't do this thing where I think that what I'm doing isn't good enough. I just don't do it anymore. It's like, this is me, this is what you get. And it's not to say that I can't be lazy, and it's not appropriate for people to say, dumb Shannon, you're being lazy, you're coasting, pull your finger up, do some more work. That's fine, but it's this, you know, this internal view of, I'm not enough. I just don't do that anymore. Which, hallelujah. Don't really get anxious anymore either. Like, I do think, put things off, and I do a bit at last minute, so I can, but that sort of, that lift, that kind of, that constant 24/7 anxiety.
Mm.
Don't do that anymore. I've just seen how much pain it causes me.
Mm. It's interesting because Itia, who was on last year's Dollar Life Course, has been doing some interviews in Melbourne.
Oh, yeah.
And she's added in some questions. Mm. And one of them is, are there any views you can comfortably say that you've seen through?
Yeah.
And that sounds a bit like that, really.
Yeah, it sounds like that. Like, and it's not to say you put me in a particular set of circumstances and that can reactivate, but it's passing. Whereas, you know, go way back. So I remember in 2001 on New Year's Day sitting talking to a dear friend at that time, and we were getting a bit stoned. And I said, I remember looking at him, and I can remember saying, I can more imagine losing my right arm than not experiencing anxiety as the predominant flavour of my mind. And at the time I meant that, like, again, it's like stone drama. Yeah, it's just not true anymore. I'm not anxious anymore.
So I'm thinking another theme that connects with this is about pleasure.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You want me to say something about pleasure?
You mentioned pleasure,
right? Yeah, so, yeah, I think there's something about... finding out what our sources of pleasure are and not feeling bad about them. So for a long, and so again, it's the integrating the inner and outer. So Dungeons and Dragons has been a major theme. Like, I describe it as one of the unresolved themes of my Dharma life. It's like, how to integrate this, and blah, 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 loads of different stories. Doing it, not doing it, doing it and feeling concealing and guilty about it. So particularly when I was moving around a lot, it was quite difficult to find out how to do that well. So when was it? In 2016, I bought myself a PS4, kind of like a games console, which you just play games for, which definitely I felt a bit bad about. And basically, I did get a bit addicted. I do have a bit of a compulsive personality. But particularly what I noticed was, what was really painful about it was, there was this, like, this hidden part of my life, which I wasn't telling people about. And also, there wasn't, you know, so I'd be talking to people. If we're talking about them, that's fine. But I haven't got anything to talk about, because all I do is meet up with people and talk to them about their lives or play on my PS4. And I remember going to Butterfield that year with Moichi Sara and realising that I've got this sort of, if you don't know about this, you don't know me. Mm-hmm. It's this sort of like this defining part of my character and my personality. So I've been on this real journey of being just much more open about that. Yeah, this sort of shame, somehow playing computer games is...
Mm.
Yeah, being addicted to the football is fine. Being addicted to computer games is shaming and demeaning somehow. So it's been a whole process of letting go of the shame and the concealment, which has been very, very positive. As it happens, I do get a bit compulsive, and I stopped doing that, which was definitely better. Now I'm into playing board games. And there's some very complex, it's not Snakes and Ladders and Monopoly, there's some very sophisticated board games out there, Which I think is good, actually. I still can get compulsive. One of my questions I ask my friends is, what do you do when you get home from a class in the evening? And I think this is where we can, the ethics of the private moment, because it feels like most people I talk to don't talk about that, and most people feel a bit guilty about what it is that they do when they get home from a class in the end. Yeah, it's kind of 10:30. So I've got an hour and a half, so I get home at 10:30 and I go to bed at 12, more or less. And I do what I can do spend a lot of time, which is I'm still a bit embarrassed about, is I can spend a lot of time reading about or watching videos about games which I may play or I do play, kind of like tactics, or the way I describe it to people, it's a bit like there's two hobbies. There's doing the hobby, and then there's reading about the hobby. So I spend quite a lot of time reading about playing games, and I wish I did less of that and more actually just playing the damn things. Yeah, so that's has been a bit of a journey. It's very interesting at the moment in Birmingham. There's quite a lot of people who like playing board games. So it actually feels like this has got much more potential to integrate it into my life, which is good. I also, for the first time in 10 years, I'm part of a board game club, which is nothing to do with Buddhism, which meets once a week, which it's the first time in 10 years that I've met people not through a Buddhist centre, if you see what I mean. And some of them I'm becoming friends with, and that's what's really interesting about that is, again, so this is March 2018, you can check back with me later if you're interested in this. So last week I drew a game and I was utterly, I could not stop my thinking for 3 or 4 hours afterwards, which was really quite unpleasant. So I got home late because it was for various reasons. So I got home at 11 o'clock. On 1 o'clock, I got up and I just couldn't, my mind was just going round and round and round and round and round and round and round. Why I hadn't won. And there's a bit of analysis where it's like, okay, there's useful information, that's why you didn't win, because you did this, you did that. But then I was just going round again and again and again. It's really unpleasant. And I was definitely thinking, does this mean you can't do this? This is too much. You need to stop doing this. And what I realised is that I've always avoided direct competition, particularly measured competition, where it's not just, because we compete all the time. But this is like it's a league where you get points and the person and somebody wins and somebody loses over time. So it's not just a one-off. And I was like, oh, this is why you're so obsessed with this, is because it's not just the game. It's what the other people playing the league think of you for drawing against this new guy who you should have beaten to a pulp. And I didn't. I only drew with him. Gosh, still annoyed about it. So that's given me some hope that I can kind of turn this around and it might be useful to me. So one of the things, this is for next day, in the night I can do it. I got to sleep at 4, like at 2 o'clock I gave up and started reading like a very immersive novel, just because I was just like, I can't do this. And what I realised was it was a good time to apply Tonglen, actually. So it's like, it's like the misfortune of things not going your way and kind of this sense of competition. I should be better than this. I should be above these other people. And I've been wronged. It's not fair. It's like fate isn't on my side. So I got to thinking, oh, you can just do Tonglen with this. Rather than obsessing about how you've been wronged and how if only you'd rolled a 2 instead of a 1, you'd have won. How annoying is that? Just had to hold it to 83% chance, that is. Anyway, I'm playing. It's like, oh yeah, you can just breathe in that sense of this sense of injustice. And actually, while you're at it, Dharmshalan, look at all the injustice that people experience in this world. You know, your injustice is that a little bit of plastic came up on a 1 instead of a 2. Look at the injustice. Yeah, breathe that in. And then it's really interesting, so what do you want to breathe out? You want to breathe out kind of ease. Actually, that's what it is, isn't it? This kind of this obsession of thinking. What we want is ease. We want to be at peace. That was really encouraging, actually. It's like, oh, look, this is living a Dharma life. This is actually applying it. This is mess in progress. And I was, you know, that was last week. And then on Tuesday night, went to bed and I was still obsessing about it a bit. So, for God's sake, come on, did that a bit. By Wednesday, I most more or less calmed down.
This part of the conversation came out of talking about pleasure.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. It's like, God, Is this pleasurable? That's another question I ask myself. Is this pleasurable? This particular game I'm playing, it's renowned. It's got particular mechanisms which make it's renowned for you cursing your bad luck. So it's the way I describe them to people, it's a bit like supporting a not very successful football team. It's like, how do you think this is pleasurable? It's engaging. There's a difference, isn't it? It's engaging. Yeah.
Mm.
But I do have a bit of a question about whether I'll stop doing it in a few months and spend more time playing games within the Sangha. It's very interesting that we're playing a game with Sangha friends on Saturday. It's this particular game. I taught everyone it. I never win. And I just really don't mind. I'm just happy to be with these people. And it's a Sangha thing. So it's people who I'm straightforwardly friends with, and then people who I'm cultivating friendship with, shall we say. Mm-hmm. Mitras who I'm, it's a way of, interesting way, including them in the life of Sangha. And I'm just very happy. Actually, they're not very competitive, which I find very... So it's like, why is that? Why is that? Very interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Work in progress. Yeah. I might start a Sangha Games Club.
Yeah. Well, it's got a bit around, but people probably don't talk about it much.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. This sort of like, that's why this kind of like the hidden pleasures. It's a good, if you ever want to ask an order member a question to get them to talk about what's really important to them, ask them what they do for fun, for pleasure.
Mm.
It's a good question to ask people.
Mm.
It gets you out of talking about moving politics and all of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether talking about this also takes us in the direction of lifestyle, which was
the
thing that you mentioned.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how much I've got to say about it, really. I suppose I've lived in communities quite a lot. I now live with Singamati, my partner, who's also the chair of the Birmingham Buddhist Centre. And it's good. I like it. There's a component, like being a celiac, I am... Singamati's happy to live in a gluten-free household, which definitely makes a positive difference to my health. So there is that. But I think, I don't know, it's... I suppose there's this question about what do we really want from our lives, and I felt like I was living in communities sort of because of an idea rather than actually necessarily a lived experience. What I really want in my life is closeness. And for me, and I don't think this is true for everyone, in fact I've got friends who definitely say it's not true for them, for me I think that there's a quality of closeness which you get through kind of like having a romantic partner, which you don't get in the Sangha. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with the Sangha or that that's bad. It's just like actually there's a quality of closeness, of in-lifeness, which is very, very hard to access within the Sangha. And as I say, I've got friends who, when I've talked about this before, they're like, no, I've got that. And they tell me, and I'm like, yeah, you have. So I do. Well done. Congratulations. I rejoice in that.
In your experience, that hasn't been the case.
Yeah, it's like, and it's just being special, isn't it? You know, we want to, it's the human desire to be special to someone, and yeah, I get that through my relationship with Singamati, which I don't get in other contexts. And it's not like, in some ways, it's interesting because I've got a lot of very, very dear friends who I love very, very deeply. And now I sort of, Singamati and I, we're 4 years into living with each other, and we bought a house a couple of years ago, so. We both say that maybe life will take us in another turn, and one or other of us will end up living in Truvatna communities or retreat centres at some point. And maybe we will, but for the moment, very happy doing that.
Mm.
And I do think it's, in a way, the big question is, or the difficult to answer questions, and I talk about this sometimes with some of my friends, is inevitably, I spend less time with other people when Singamati's around. In a way, you know that for sure, because when Singamati goes away, I spend a lot more time with other people. But the question is, am I happier, more at ease? Am I a better human being because I live with her than I would be if I had lived in a community? And that's a hard question to answer. Yeah.
So if you sort of looking back over your Dharma life, as in looking over a landscape, and somebody were to say to you, what matters It's a very big open question.
What matters?
I suppose in a way it's a bit like looking back and then thinking about if there's something that you'd want to say to somebody who's coming along now, setting out on Dharma life.
Oh, but that's you asking two slightly different questions now. So, what do I think matters, and what do I want to say to someone starting?
Yeah, they are two different questions, but maybe they have a relationship with each other.
They do, and this is where when I talk about much so, and I talk about this sometimes, the way that everyone's got one Dharma talk, and they might talk about different things, but they've got one core message. So, for me, the core message is definitely something about live wholeheartedly, live honestly. Yeah, that's that again and again. That's the kind of core thing I come back to. And it's important to caveat that it doesn't mean to say indulge your negative mental states. It means, in a way, it's like live wholeheartedly and really live out what is important to you. Mm-hmm. So I remember this talk I gave in 2011 on the Young Buddhist Weekend. One of the things I said, which a friend who's ordained now said really hit her at the time. I said, work out what's important to you, and Buddhism isn't a good enough answer. And what I meant by that was Buddhism's too vague, too general. So what is it that you really care about? Is it Sangha? Is it community? Is it studying for Dharma? Is it meditation? Is it for metta bhavana? Is it perhaps something? You know, it's got to be more vivid. It's got to be more real. So I think that's what I try and encourage people to do. That kind of the move towards wholeness, honesty. I love in a way this then more goes into the what I think is most important. There's this image in a book called The Mutant Message from Down Under. It's a book about Aborigines. And it's in a point she's talking about the author saying that everyone is so so honest. That low level telepathy develops, because actually nobody's hiding their emotions, nobody's concealing, nobody's having bitchy thoughts about each other, which then they then think, oh, I can't let anyone see that I think that. So they live in a kind of perfect society, as it were. And I think, I believe that's possible, at least metaphorically, may it be so. So yeah, I talk about this a lot. You know, if you want to be completely spontaneous, if you want to be completely authentic, the only way to do that is to thoroughly practice a metta bhavana, so that all of your thoughts and actions are of love and kindness. Because then you can say and do whatever you want, because whatever you do and want won't harm anyone. So that's sort of what I think that's what I want in my life. Like, I'm not that interested in enlightenment as an abstract concept, but that idea of purity, actually, purity of heart. So then what do I think is most important? The conditions which give rise to that purity of heart. And in a sense, we're all a product of our conditions. So, Harshaprabha, Sadaraja particularly, Subhuti, Sangadeva, Mahamati, they all crucial people in my life, my Dharma life, they all profoundly exemplify the importance of Kalyana Mitrata. And I feel that I have a duty to carry that on. Yeah, particularly one of the negative consequences of the diversifying of lifestyle choices in Trivana. It's just patently obvious that the thread of Kalyana Mitrata is much, much weaker than it was in the past. Like, I look back when I was a Mitra in 2002, I was meeting up with order members every week, like probably two different order members every week. Like, my mitras, bless their hearts, if somebody meets up with them, twice a year, that's a bit of an exaggeration, they're doing okay. It's not that bad, but partly that's their lives. They've got very busy, complicated lives with families, and partly that's our lives. That was an exaggeration, but So how do we weave the spell of the Dharma? How do we weave the spell of the Sangha when there's so much more in all of our lives? And the answer is, it's really hard. But that's, as Mitra convener here in Birmingham, that's the kind of my recurring question, how to encourage and support people to connect connect and communicate on the basis of Dharma, which is what builds Sangha, which inspires them to transform their lives and become like the Buddha. There you go.
That feels like an ending point.
That felt like an ending point as I said that as well. Not what I was particularly thinking about before I started saying it.
Yeah. I mean, I had in mind this, as I mentioned before, this question about what the centrality of going for refuge means to you, and I kind of have a sense you've said that in what you've just said. I don't know if there's anything you'd add to that.
The centrality of going for refuge. Yeah. I'm happy with that as language. I suppose the only thing I would add to that is something I got from Subhuti, which I think is really, really important, which I don't feel that people necessarily get, so I'm taking my chance to tell the world, an understanding of the Sangha Jewel. So the Sangha Jewel is, what inspires me about the Sangha Jewel is the possibility of transformed human relationships. Because do you see what I'm... So you've got the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha as... So you've got the Buddha, the texts and the Arya Sangha as things. And then we talk about the Buddha as being the possibility of awakening for you. We talk about the Dharma as being a path which you can follow. And I feel that often people don't have a livable principle for the Sangha in the same way. And I think that's a flaw in people's presentations. So for me, which I think is most important, most immediately attractive, like what would it be like to relate to a bunch of human beings when you're not primarily motivated by greed, hatred and delusion? What would we create together if that was the case? So I often say to people, that's what gets me out of bed in the morning, is my fumbling and groping and characterised by laziness and doing things too quickly, attempts to answer that question. So I suppose it occurs to me that... just to really celebrate friendship. So it's just... One of the questions I've been asking myself recently is why am I in the order? It's not in a particularly weird way, but I think it's good to ask oneself that question. And in some ways, I think there's a number of different ways you can answer that. One of them you can answer is like the experience of being with the order. So I was just in Bodhgaya for the convention, and in a way I was surprised by... It's not that I didn't feel moved by being with the order, but it didn't touch me in the way that it has done in the past. And in some ways, that isn't necessarily a problem, but it does raise a question mark, because that's always been an important... It's been about like that for maybe four years now. Up until then, that had been a really important touchstone of my membership of the order, you know, that experience of being together in large numbers. And I have to be honest with myself, it just doesn't move me in the same way anymore. Doesn't mean there's anything wrong with me or if there's anything wrong with the order, but it does raise an important question, because one does need a direct, tangible touchstone of confidence and sense of the order to, I think, to maintain a healthy relationship with it. So then my mind obviously turns to my individual relationships with my friends, and I'm incredibly fortunate with the breadth and depth of friendships that I experience within this order. It is truly wonderful and to be celebrated. And, yeah, like I suppose, just to name a few of those, just to sort of honour them, you know, my early years in Colchester and Ipswich, which are Buddha Siha Sanghanista particularly, just growing into men together, so important. You know, those years... True Ratna was primarily a vehicle to try and find out what it was to be a man, frankly, and, you know, deservedly so. But also Kaunadi, Sangamani, Sujani, you know, good friends. I remember being, you know, this whole thing of men and women, and I remember just thinking, well, I'm going to have meaningful friendships with women because I think that's important to me, and just go off and do that, and it's fine, actually. So then my teachers... you know, too many to name, but particularly, you know, Sadaraja, Subhuti, Mahamati, public and private preceptors, and then Subhuti, who, you know, just such a foundational influence in my understanding of the Dharma. So grateful to the time and energy they've given me, the love they've expressed. And then latterly, Vidyaruchi, Sinamanas, particularly, you know, kind of friends who've shared a particular phase of our lives, kind of working for Subhuti and Bhante, and kind of a connection that forms. And then all the other friends I haven't mentioned, so many. But then I'm trying to answer this question If my membership of the order is predicated purely upon my personal relationships, that isn't good enough, actually. There's something wrong with that. And then at Bulgaria this time, I sort of felt like I found a new answer for the time being. Padma Vajra as well, very, very kind to me, particularly in recent years since joining the Mitrokhin Venus meeting. So many good friends. Sangharuchi, another dear friend of the current moment, sorry. I was talking to Moksha Tara, who I've known since 2011. So we've kind of been friends for 7 years, but we just had this one day when we sat down and got talking, and we talked for a couple of hours, which is probably more time than we spent talking to each other in the rest of the time we've known each other. And we just really talked about what was most important and deepest to us. And it wasn't like at the time I was aware of that, and I sort of felt, oh, this is significant. And it was only afterwards I was thinking, oh, well, this is why I'm a member of the order. And it sort of ties back to what I was saying about Sangha earlier. It's like, I'm a member of the order because of the possibility of communication, which is different to the actual experience. You know, it's like any one instance of it. It's like, here's this woman who I've known for a number of years, but we can talk about what is most important and personal to us without us being drunk and pretending we forgot about it, the next day pretending we spoke about it, without just being strangers passing on the train where we cannot live with the consequences of the words we've said. And that is magic. That is deeply and truly special. And that for now, and is why I'm a member of the order, is because this order, more reliably than any other context I've experienced in my life, creates the conditions where that possibility of communication is possible, and that is truly precious in this world. And I will serve that for my own sake and for the sake of others.
Mm. And you were talking about how threads of Kalyan Mitra have got thinner, Mitras coming along. Now, there's something in there about, well, I mean, I recognise what you say, and and there is that, and also, well, like when you're talking about lifestyle and like choosing how you want to live, and again, I resonate with that. When I was a Mitra, you know, I had people meeting up with me left, right, and centre, and I choose to live on my own and don't meet up regularly with anybody, and I'm kind of interested in that tension that we hold, where we've had that as Mitras.
Yeah.
And we're choosing lifestyles which feel authentic, but which mean that we're making choices that mean we're doing less of what people did for us.
Yep.
I just wonder if you've got any more to say about how you hold that tension, because I recognise that myself. Yeah. I just want to really say that.
I think it's a crucial question for the future of the order. That sounds a bit dramatic, but I'm given saying things a bit dramatically. Yeah, I suppose there's a few things. One of them is, I think, first of all, we need to acknowledge that it's changed, not feel bad about it, and just say, okay, this is it. Because I think I think one of the dangers is our order and movement goes through like a natural lifestyle cycle, and we as individuals all go through that natural lifestyle cycle. And I think it's natural that at a certain point people want to retire, in inverted commas. They want to do less, they want to engage less. And I think it would be a tragedy, or I think it is a tragedy to the extent that it happens, that people feel that they're bad and wrong, and therefore sort of getting to this thing where they feel like they're being criticised because they're not living up to the ideal, and then they feel bad, and then because it's painful to feel bad, they then criticise the ideal.
Mm.
And I definitely see that, particularly in order members in their late 50s and 60s. And sometimes I just think it's tragic. I look at them, I think, God, you slogged your guts out for 20 years. Now you want to rest. And you feel bad about it. It's like, that's insane. Mm. You don't feel bad about it. And conversely, I think if you don't feel bad about it, you're more likely to do a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one component of it. The other component is, well, yeah, the younger people do need to kind of do as much as they can to help people grow. And I think we need to get... And this is probably the most contentious part of it. I think we need to get more intelligent about the nature of the Kalyana Mitra we give to people, or what that looks like. So this is an analogy I'll experiment on you with. So I feel like Tree Matters kind of was a meat and two veg community, and the meat was live in a community, work in my livelihood, spend lots of time meeting up with order members. Kind of that whole image of Kellyanne Michetow's rounding off rough edges by battling around in a box. So effectively what Tree Matter has done, willingly or unwillingly, is it's gone vegan. So it's taken the meat off of the plate and you've just got the veg left. What concerns me is that again and again, what I hear people saying is, we need to get the meat back. And everyone's, you know, this is, I don't know what it's like from the women's side. So on the men's side, everyone talks about, oh, we need conditions for intensity. We need to create intensity. It can't look like what it used to look like. It needs to look like something new. And nobody knows what that looks like. I'm not convinced by that as an argument. I think what we need to do is we need to much more intelligently explore and find out what it is to apply the Dharma in individual people's lives. So there are shoots of this happening, which I feel very, very positive and encouraged by. So, you know, the 7-point mind training slogans would be a good example where, yeah, I felt for a number of years that they could be a way of really tangibly helping people who lead busy, full-on lives live a Dharma life in their experience. And so I'm very heartened to see those teachings being more widely taught. I think Subhuti's really good on this, actually. You know, he thinks deeply about this, and I think he's thought a lot about this in the context of the Indian movement. And I'm not up to date with his recent thinking, and I don't know quite how that applies over here. But I do think it's important. And I suppose just to finish, because you asked how's that different. So I feel as a Mitra, what I got was a lot of encouragement, and I wonder if what our Mitras now need is more direct mentoring, actually, which strays into all kinds of like professionalization and mentoring and techniqueism, which I'm cautious about. But yet I look at them and I think they don't see enough of me. They need, my Mitras, in inverted commas, need more than just encouragement if they're going to transform their lives. But how to do that, what that looks like, is a work in progress. And I've got some ideas which I'm going to be trying to implement later this year.
Interesting. Watch this space. March, yeah, watch this space. 2018, see what happens.
Yeah. Well, you can turn the record off and then I'll tell you.